There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. Better world is coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. It's another evening of Progressive News Network. Going to welcome you. Tell you we've got a great lineup tonight and some very good news. We'll be talking to union brothers and sisters tonight. First guest will be Nick Sergey, who is Director of Research for the Center of Media and Democracy. He'll be addressing his research on ALEC. We've all heard about it. Now you're going to have an in-depth presentation on ALEC. Its tentacles, its tension, its dollars, and how we can defeat it. Then we've got Miss Gypsy Gallardo, organizer with Agenda 2010, editor in the Chief Power Broker magazine. And Rick Smith, Chief of Staff, SEIU. And we'll also be joined later by Alfonso Mayfield, President of SEIU, Florida Public Service Union. And then Chuck Ridley, a community leader. And he's working with the Alliance of Delray. So we've got a wonderful lineup of guests, ladies and gentlemen, and now the news. But before we do the news, I want to play something special for you. Many of us have learned, to our immense chagrin, that even more of the internet is bugged than we thought. Yeah, we knew that the government's taking a look. Yeah, we knew that anything that you put up on the internet's public and is probably likely to be listened to and watched. But here's an internet security specialist who brings out a special idea. This is a little clip from Democracy Now. This is Bruce Schneider with the Berkman Center Technology.
At the same time, it turns out, they are doing these exact same things. And now when we go into international meetings and say, we need an open internet, we need a free internet, the countries all look at each other and now going to say, well, you can't trust the Americans. And guess what? You can't trust the Americans. So what the U.S. is doing is actually undermining U.S. efforts to maintain a free and open internet. That's very frustrating. It's counterproductive. It's damaging to us, to the world. And you know, I wish it wasn't so, but it turns out we are not being good stewards of the internet.
Do you see signs of a major pushback by American technology companies who obviously are dependent on being able to sell their products internationally? For instance, Microsoft now with these revelations about its cooperation with the government on its Outlook and other systems, whether they're going to be basically rebelling now because their business model is going to be endangered by these continuing revelations?
I think so. We've already seen that with the news about PRISM. Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Apple are all pushing back, demanding to be allowed to talk about what they're giving the NSA. The problem is, as you said, their credibility is ruined. We're not going to trust Apple with our data if we think the NSA is going to get it. These companies are losing enormous business, especially overseas and in the U.S. because of this, and they are no longer willing allies because it hurts their credibility. Now these new revelations appear, and again, you're going to see this public-private surveillance partnership splitting as there's pressure on the corporations to come forward, to be forthright, and to protect their customers and users. So my hope is, as these stories come out, more will come out. Right? You know, these companies are not under confidentiality rules, they don't have clearances, they're cooperating either because they think it's a good idea, because they've been coerced, that they can make their stories public. The more stories we know, the more we hear, the more we will hear, the more we'll know what's going on, and I think the more companies will start pushing back.
Bruce Schneier, as we wrap up, what surprised you most about the NSA and documents that were released?
Yeah, it's funny. As security people, all of this we expected. I mean, there's no real surprises here. What I guess is surprising is how pervasive it was, how large it was, and how much collusion there was between government and industry. We knew there were some, but we didn't realize it was this incredibly widespread.
We want to thank you for being with us, and we look forward to speaking to you again. Bruce Schneier, security technologist, encryption specialist, fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Society recently wrote an article for The Guardian, How to Remain Secure Against NSA Surveillance. We'll link to it at democracynow.org.
See, we've been giving countries across the world a hard time whenever they step on the internet, when they limit it, when they throttle it, when they filter it. We've been saying, hey, we're the gold standard of internet security. We're the hands-off. We're the freebies. We don't mess with it. And guess what? All that stuff's out the window. And more than that, and this is the really devastating part, at least in a commercial context. Now, think about it this way. You know, the software industry, America, the Western countries have had just, you know, they have been the provider of choice. Windows software, Microsoft software, Apple software, Skype, you name it. These are the ubiquitous tools used around the web. So now that it's come out that all these tools have been created with government access, full backdoor, the encryption's got backdoors in it, well, you know, that's going to be a hit on our technology industries as well. And, of course, when those people who decided that you don't need any security, you don't need any privacy, when they made that decision, they just really didn't care, you know? Okay, and now the news. Radiation's levels reach new peaks in Fukushima. I suppose we should just put that on a tape loop and play it every time we start the show, because it seems that every week they make a new announcement. And it turns out that last week's high levels were where they were was because their meters didn't read any higher. Had they read higher, the levels would have been reported much higher. But okay, guess what? They've got new meters, and now the levels are higher. I wonder if next week when they put new meters in, will the same thing happen again? Radiation hotspots have spread to three holding tanks for hundreds of hastily built tanks storing water contaminated by being flushed over the three reactors that melted down at Fukushima Daiichi. Now they've also admitted that there is an aquifer underneath Fukushima. It leads to the sea, and it also connects to Tokyo. So, hey, isn't that just fantastic? The aquifer that Tokyo depends on is also directly underneath Fukushima. But listen, priorities being what they were, they got the Olympics. Hey, fantastic. Rising radiation levels and leaks to the plant have prompted international alarm. The Japanese government said on Tuesday it would step in with almost $500 million of funding to fix the growing levels of contamination at the plant. Readings just above the ground near a set of tanks at the plant show radiation as high as 2,200 millisieverts. The Nuclear Regulatory Agency said on Wednesday the previous high area in that same neighborhood was 1,800 millisieverts recorded on Saturday. Saturday, then Sunday, hey, new levels. Both levels will be enough to kill an unprotected person within hours. The NRA said that recently discovered hotspots are highly concentrated and easily shielded. The tanks sit on a hill above the Pacific Ocean at the Fukushima plant. Hey, don't tell anyone, water runs downhill, which was devastated by a massive earthquake and tsunami on March 2011. Triggering the worst nuclear crisis since Chernobyl a quarter of a century later. Too little, too late, the plant operator, Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, said last month. Water from the tanks are leaking, and a small leak was found, and the NRA raised severity of the initial leak from a level 1 anomaly to a level 3 serious incident. Okay, and don't forget, you can always go for more of the details to the website averyvoice.com, averyvoice.com. We'll take you to the details of tonight's news, stories that I get to, stories that I don't get all the way through. Definitely go there and check it out. There is a group of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS. One of the leaders is Ray McGovern, former CIA person. They've sent a note to the president that Syria is a trap. We regret to inform you some of our former coworkers are telling us categorically that contrary to the claims of your administration, the most reliable intelligence shows that Bashar al-Assad was not responsible for the chemical incident that killed and injured Syrian civilians on August 21st. and the British intelligence also know this. I'm writing this brief because we chose to assume you have not been fully informed because your advisors decided to afford you the opportunity for what's known as plausible deniability. That was Ollie North's favorite phrase. We've been down this road before with President George W. Bush, who we addressed our first VIPS memorandum immediately after Colin Powell's February 5th, 2003 speech. The fraudulent nature of Powell's speech was a no-brainer. Our sources confirmed the chemical incident of some sort did cause fatalities and injuries on August 21st in a suburb of Damascus. They insist, however, that the incident was not the result of an attack by Syrian army using military-grade chemical weapons. That is the most salient fact, according to the CIA officials working the Syria issue. They tell us that CIA Director John Brennan is perpetrating a pre-Iraq war-type fraud on members of Congress, the media, and the public. Hey, who would have guessed that? Okay, maybe they can get, Rumsfeld is on the case. He's totally for it. Cui bono, they ask, that various groups are trying to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have ample incentive to get the U.S. more deeply involved in support of their effort. Until now, it's not been quite clear that the Netanyahu government in Israel has equally powerful incentive to get Washington more deeply engaged in the coming war. But with outspoken urging coming from Israel and those Americans who lobby for Israeli interest, this priority is Israeli objective is becoming crystal clear. Okay, next story. A physician statement by Canadian officials indicates that Fukushima contamination has been detected in fish at levels that are difficult to explain without undue alarm. Sockeye salmon sushi use a Geiger counter, the story says. Spawning sockeye salmon journey via the northern Pacific current from the top of Japan to northern California, British Columbia, and Alaska. The same current carries whatever Fukushima is in the process of vomiting forth, bathing salmon and herring all along the way in a radioactive cesium. We need to test the fish. Nobody, no entity, no country tests salmon for radiation exposure. Get out your meters, folks. Professor and Canadian research chair at Preventive Medicine and Population Center at British Columbia and the former president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, Dr. Erica Frank, the bit that needs fixing here is our inevitable deadly reliance on nuclear power. Yummy tuna and salmon today, the most export products from Japan. What happens when the same thing happens at Hartford and any other nuclear power station? Dr. Erica Frank, in particular, that this piece that indicates to me they found levels detectable but difficult to explain without undue alarm. To date, all results have been produced show that no radionuclides are present above actionable layers levels. This means that we have not found evidence of radioactivity in any food levels at levels of concern. Once the agency has conducted its rigorous quality control, it will publish all test results on its website. That's the Canadian Food Inspection Agency communication. Okay, next story. Deformed vegetables and fruit reportedly pop up around the nuclear plant in Fukushima. Google it. 2 years after Japan's worst nuclear disaster displaced 21,000 residents of Namie, most of the town remains the same. Just miles from the Fukushima nuclear plant, roofs that collapsed in the magnitude 9.0 earthquake still litter the roads. Newspapers from March 12th, the day after the disaster struck, are stacked high at the newspaper's office. But we can't get into any more news right now. Let me go on and get you the interview of Mr. Nick Sergey, who's going to talk to you about ALEC. And here we go, Mr. Nick Sergey. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Mr. Nick Sergey, Director of Research at the Center for Media and Democracy. Mr. Sergey is going to help us understand ALEC and the work that they're doing. You may excuse my overcharacterization, basically to subvert democracy. Sir, welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Sir, you're involved in such interesting work. Why don't you kind of give us an overview of your responsibilities and the work that you've been doing?
Sure. So I'm Director of Research at the Center for Media and Democracy, and some of your listeners may know that a couple of years ago we launched a project called ALEC Exposed, which is really exposing the operations and the work of the American Legislative Exchange Council over the last 40 years. And I lead a lot of our research projects here, so really digging deep on ALEC and also some other groups, but a lot of our work focuses on their activities, and there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into trying to expose what they're doing, trying to obtain their agenda for their meetings, And, you know, the outcome of that is really that ALEC has become almost a household name, really, at least with informed progressives. But, you know, behind the scenes, there's an incredible amount of work. So, for example, over the last 4 to 6 weeks, we filed about 1,000 public records requests in 7 states across the country. And the result of that is that we have found out what ALEC was talking about at their last conference. So we are more aware now of the latest attacks that are going to be coming really in January, when most of the states come back and begin their sessions again.
You know, you make an interesting point that over the last couple of years, probably not much more than 3 or 4, more and more people who pay attention to politics, especially progressive activists, have become aware of ALEC. I suppose if you think about it really coldly and calculatedly, when we have come to understand how much of our legislation is written not so much by legislators who have that responsibility, but instead is passed off to lobbyists, I suppose in retrospect it's not that surprising that so much legislation comes from a front group like ALEC. I understand they have had their 40th anniversary. How did ALEC start?
Yeah, so it's a little murky, actually, and there often are. There are different views on how ALEC started. But what we understand was about 40 years ago in Chicago, a group of Republican state legislators got together, and they decided that this is obviously before the Internet era, decades before the Internet era, they decided that they needed a way of effectively sharing legislation that they had written. Interestingly, at that point, it didn't seem to be that corporations were writing the legislation, which is what ALEC later became. And so they created this nonprofit called ALEC, and it was, you know, within their incorporations documents, they made it very clear that this is an organization that was not lobbying, was not going to lobby. They weren't going to actively promote and push any particular bill, but they were more like a library. And that is still how ALEC talks about itself, but that is not what they've become. Over the really over the first decade of their existence, from 1973 into the early 1980s, corporations really took power within ALEC. Corporate money flooded in. They hired a lot of staffers. They moved from Illinois to Washington, D.C. Paul Weyrich, who's a big figure on the right in conservative politics during that time, also founded the Republican Study Group, the Heritage Foundation, and others. He was trying to create these organizations that would push a particular right-wing conservative agenda. He was fundamental in that shift from the move from the states, in the Midwest, out to Washington, D.C., and driving corporate money into the organization. And from then on, they started to adopt particular bills that they would promote as models, rather than just simply having a library of legislation that legislators can pick and choose from. It's really a fundamental shift in the way that the organization was run. And as a result, they started to push legislation like, well, later voter ID, Stand Your Ground. But in those early years in the 1980s, there was a lot of legislation that was attacking unions. Right to Work was a bill that they adopted in the early 80s, which had been around for obviously many decades prior to that. But really, ALEC pushing it meant that it became adopted in many, many more states.
Now, from the Right to Work movement, the breakup of unions, they've also involved, should we say, the morality legislation. They've also been involved in gun legislation. Exactly what's the scope of their efforts these days? Could you talk to the range of things that they're pushing?
Yeah, and it's pretty broad. I mean, it's varied over the years. At its core, there has always been legislation that they are pushing that very clearly benefits the bottom line of whichever particular corporations or right-wing foundations are funding it at any particular time. There have been some pretty solid constants in terms of their funding. The Koch brothers, for example, have funded ALEC through their foundations for many, many years, as have the Scaife Foundation and many other of these big right-wing foundations that fund a lot of these kind of groups. And so they've tended to have this anti-union, anti-regulation, particularly regulation as it pertains to workplace rights, environmental protections, and anything really that could affect the bottom line of the corporation. But you're right in that they've also had this other strand running through them, where they have promoted lessening of gun safety laws, you know, making it far easier to get a gun and far more difficult for the authorities to track who has got a gun. And that has really come through the NRA. And it's questionable whether the NRA are still within ALEC. The NRA were for many, many years, you know, even we have a photograph of the first ever ALEC meeting that took place in Illinois in the early 1970s. And there, at the first event, is the president of the NRA. So the NRA has been involved from the very start. Now, ALEC claims, under really an amazing amount of public pressure a year ago, to have dropped the particular task force they organize around these different task forces that deal with issues like commerce, the environment, healthcare, education. They used to have one that dealt with what they call public safety and elections. It's pretty broad range. It dealt with gun legislation. It promoted laws such as Stand Your Ground, which was obviously implicated in the tragic death of Trayvon Martin, and incidentally was part of the jury instructions that led to the acquittal of George Zimmerman. But also, that task force included legislation such as voter ID, which is a very obvious attempt by the Republican Party or elements of the Republican Party in order to make it more difficult for certain parts of the electorate who tend to vote Democratic, typically minorities, the elderly, and students, to vote by placing unnecessary burdens on them at the ballot box, despite, you know, by claiming that there is fraud taking place when there's no evidence that's true in any sort of statistically significant way. And so they had this very broad task force. You know, under mounting pressure, they claim to have stopped pushing that particular agenda. And so it's questionable whether the NRA is still in. But they still have this incredibly broad agenda that, for example, tries to make it easier for corporations to engage in fracking in order to try and release natural gas and oil reserves that would otherwise be unreachable, and to try and drive down regulation around fracking so that the companies involved, ExxonMobil, to a limited extent Koch Industries, don't have to release details of the chemicals that they're pumping into our ground, which, you know, local residents who are concerned about their own health and the health of their children want to know what they're putting in the ground. Well, ALEC has a bill to try and stop that. They had a bill that made it easier to increase offshore drilling, for example, in the era when we had the tragic accident off the Gulf Coast. So they really engage in a whole range of issues, and they appear to be, from the documents that we have obtained, doing this in direct response to, well, I think it's undeniable, but they're doing this in the direct response to particular funding that comes in. And so there's a lot of companies that are engaging in fracking that are now moving into ALEC, for an example, which is why they suddenly have this range of legislation that's popping up. TransCanada, who are the proposed builders of the Keystone XL pipeline, have become very involved within ALEC. Suddenly, ALEC is promoting legislation that calls on the federal government to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. That bill was introduced in 7 states in 2013. They also organized a ALEC Academy. You see, ALEC organizes under this myth that what they are doing is not lobbying, despite the fact that they have over 800 bills that they are promoting. They say, no, we are not lobbying. We are merely doing education. And therefore, they organize as a 501c3, the particular type of the tax code that allows them to organize so that companies can not only fund them secretly, but can fund them and get a tax deduction. So we, the public, are actually subsidizing this lobbying activity. And they continue that theme by providing legislators with free tickets to come to their conferences. They put them up in hotels. They call those expenses, which would usually be considered lobbying expenses, they call them scholarships. And they organize trips where they are lobbied to. For example, there was one that took place in Alberta last year. Keystone XL was top on the agenda. TransCanada were involved, and they called that a ALEC Academy. And so it's almost like they are laughing at us by continuing this education tree, but there's really no doubt that what they are doing is lobbying.
Let me ask you a question. Do we know any approximate way how many scholarships are legislators getting per year?
We have some information on that. We know that it's a little tricky to tell in that there is such a delay in
reporting.
tax information, becoming public. And we have this same problem when we're trying to track a lot of these groups that are spending huge amounts of money in the election, that there is typically about an 18-month delay before we actually get to see their tax filings, by which time, you know, the election is long past.
Sure.
We're in the same situation with ALEC, really. We are expecting to get a copy of their 2012 tax filing in about a month's time. Uh-huh. And obviously, we're at the end of 2013. And at that time, we'll be able to see quite how much money they spent on scholarships. But it's about $1 million a year in past years. That's how much. And it's actually quite incredible the way that this scheme operates. We released a report on the ALEC Scholarship Fund just a month ago, around the time of their big annual meeting that took place in Chicago. And the way that it operates is that every single state has an ALEC state chair. These are legislators, and they're paired up with a corporation in that particular state. They're usually a lobbyist from that corporation, usually a pretty senior lobbyist, you know, like a vice president of public affairs or something like that, senior member of staff. And the two of them, the legislator and the lobbyist, go out to other corporations and they ask for money. They ask for checks to be written into the scholarship fund so that they and their fellow legislators can attend the ALEC conferences. And this is really remarkable when you think about it, because this is a legislator approaching corporations. These corporations have interests. They have things that they want from these legislators. And typically, these corporations are already funding ALEC. And they're having things that they are asking of these legislators, and the legislator asks them for money. And we have no way of tracking that, because if a corporation writes a check to a legislator to pay for their campaign fund, which is illegal in most states, but in a few it's legal, then that would be a public information. You know, it has to be disclosed. But when it goes into the scholarship fund, we can never find that. We've only found out splatterings of this information through public records requests. And when we've highlighted this information, we put that out in a report just a month ago.
Isn't it true that a lot of the legislation drafted by ALEC and being introduced across the United States is often changed very little, so it's fairly easy to track, let's say, whether it be a voter ID law or union anti-union legislation. They oftentimes, they don't, it's not changed at all. It's just introduced copy after copy after copy across the states.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes that's the case, and when that happens, it actually makes our job quite a lot easier. We put out a report on the scholarship fund. We actually put out a second report at the same time during the ALEC conference. You know, it's such a huge deal for them having their 40th anniversary conference back in Chicago. We put out a report looking at how many ALEC bills were introduced in 2013. So we had to try and track those bills. We had to try and identify them. We found 466 ALEC bills this year. Some of them are exactly word for word. You're quite right. In fact, there was a bill that I found from a legislator in Florida called Rachel Bergen that she introduced in 2011, and it was a bill calling on the federal government to reduce corporate taxes. So you don't have to go far to realize why the corporations might want to be pushing that particular bill. Rachel Bergen made a mistake. There is an opening paragraph stamped on each of these ALEC bills that talks about who ALEC is. You know, ALEC is the American
right.
Legislative Exchange Council, blah, blah, blah. But you take that off, it's like the tag on a you know, new sweater that you get. You don't go out wearing that. You take off that tag that explains who ALEC is. She didn't do that. So embarrassingly, the first line on her bill was talking about ALEC. She obviously noticed within 24 hours. The next day, instead of amending the bill, she withdrew it completely. And then another day later, she introduced the same bill, but without that paragraph. But, you know, we spotted that, and she, I think, was quite embarrassed by that. But it's easy for us to track, well, it's very easy for us to track these bills if they say ALEC in them. It's relatively easy for us to track if they have exactly the same language, but only because 2 years ago, a whistleblower came to the Center for Media and Democracy and handed over the language of all of these 800-plus model bills, because before that, we actually had no idea what the language was in most of them. So, you know, it was, even though they were word for word, and we could see this pattern of bills attacking workers' rights or bills to, you know, deregulate the financial markets or whatever it might be, popping up all across the country, we couldn't say with any certainty that they were an ALEC bill. But now, armed with these really huge pile of bills, some that range from a page to some that are sort of 40, 50 pages, were able to do that legwork. It's a lot of work. To make life more difficult, what happens in a lot of state houses is that a legislator, when they have this ALEC model bill, they'll take it to a drafts person within the state house, and they'll, you know, make changes in order to make it fit with the particular language and existing legislation that is in any particular state. And it'll actually, even though the legislator will have given the bill that is the ALEC bill straight in, you know, they'll make alterations. And sometimes that's why the bill language changes. But you're quite right. A lot of the time it is word for word exactly the same all
Incredible.
The way through the bill.
Besides lazy, it's stupid. You know, gosh, let's hope all our foes are fools. Let me ask you this. Can anyone go to an ALEC meeting, or is it by invitation only?
Well, you probably go if you pay. I mean, that's the way that they operate. I think if you're a corporation and you're willing to pay $7,000 to $25,000 to get one of your staffers in, you can probably get in. If you're somebody like you or me,
you know where I'm headed.
Yeah. Well, so I've tried to attend a few ALEC conferences, and the last one was obviously in Chicago, but the one before that was in Oklahoma City earlier this year, and I amazingly managed to obtain press credentials, which I wasn't necessarily expecting. But I thought I would try, because we had a legitimate argument for why we're covering ALEC.
Sure.
And so I went to Oklahoma City. I got inside the conference center. I was going to the only one part of the conference that was open to the press, which was a speech from the governor in Oklahoma City, who's called Mary Fallon. And interestingly, she was a former legislator, state legislator, and was named ALEC Legislator of the Year in 2009. So, you know, they like her a lot. She says exactly what they want her to say. And so they had this 1-hour-long session in the whole 3-day conference that was open to the press. I walked inside, and I was in there 6 minutes. I timed it before I was thrown out by an ALEC staffer. I had my press credentials removed, and she had a police officer who, it later transpired, was off duty and paid for by either ALEC or the hotel in order to provide them with protection. So they're extremely cautious about making sure that anyone that might be critical, and in the past that's included news organizations like Al-Qaeda, excuse me, Al Jazeera. Well, I'm sure they would try and exclude Al-Qaeda. But anyway, many, many news organizations and reporters have tried to get in, and anybody who has any kind of track record of writing critical art about ALEC will not be welcome.
I would guess that having press credentials is kind of like having pariah stepped on your head, right?
Yeah, and actually, we later obtained a copy of a document that ALEC had been passing out to their staffers that explained why they so quickly identified me. I had my photograph on it and my name, along with seven other people, three of my colleagues from the Center for Media and Democracy, and four other individuals, both researchers and reporters, who have covered ALEC in a critical way. And so, you know, they're really doing their research in order to try and make sure that they're going to exclude people who might be writing critical stories about them.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that Chicago conference?
Sure. So ALEC has three conferences a year, but their annual meeting, which is the one that takes place in the summer, is really the big one. They usually claim that they're going to have about 2,000 legislators and lobbyists getting together and, together voting on legislation, hearing presentations from lobbyists, being wined and dined, various different dinners and events where, you know, typically they serve hors d'oeuvres and cocktails. They have a cigar party. That sort of thing. But it's a big deal for them, and it brings in a lot of money. They have a lot of corporate sponsorship. We obtained documents that showed that the top rate of corporate sponsorship for the Chicago event was $100,000 from eight particular corporations. So, you know, it's a significant amount of money for them to put on this huge conference. But it's also significant because this is their 40th anniversary, and they are returning to Chicago, which is the city in which they were born 40 years ago. And also particularly significant because Chicago saw the largest, by far the largest protest that has yet taken place against ALEC. And this has really been building for the last 2 years, ever since they held a spring meeting in Cincinnati, Ohio in 2011. And there were, I think, up to around 500 local protesters who came out really for the first time showing ALEC that there were, protesters who were willing to actually go out and picket their meeting, which had never happened before in their entire 40-year history. And you fast forward a little over 2 years, and in Chicago there were almost 3,000 protesters ringing the hotel, lobbyists trapped inside, looking out through the glass windows with their cell phones, amazed, taking photos of this huge protest outside. So I think we've really broken through now to the point where people realize the significance of ALEC, and it's really become a toxic brand, and that's why so many corporations have been fleeing ALEC over the last 2 years, and not just because of the stories around their connections to Stand Your Ground, but now really so many bills. And I think ALEC really epitomizes what people think is wrong with politics, which is this very cozy relationship between corporate lobbyists and legislators. And you can't get any cozier than cigar parties and hors d'oeuvres and cocktails and sitting by the bar at the hotel in a foreign state. And so it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. ALEC is meeting in Washington, D.C. at the end of this year, and they're planning to have a big gala celebration at a hotel. And they're having a conference at the same time. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of response there is there.
Let me ask you this. A lot of people, when they mention ALEC, they typically mention the governor of Wisconsin, talking about how he's really working right out of their playbook. Do you see Governor Walker as a particular ALEC darling, or just one more of a group of up-and-coming people who are trying to take advantage of resources available to them?
Yeah, so, I mean, we do see him as being particularly close to ALEC. I mean, the thing about ALEC is that it really has had very significant effect on Republican politics over the last 40 years. Although it's an organization that's focused at the state level, many of those state legislators go on to serve in national office. And so Eric Cantor and John Boehner were both former members of ALEC, and obviously they exert huge influence over the United States Congress. But Scott Walker was a member of ALEC for many years. And when he became governor, he really ran with a lot of those ALEC principles. And when he famously introduced the budget repair bill 2 years ago, and that led to the mass protests in Wisconsin and the occupation of the Capitol, really those were ALEC principles that he was pushing. And it was very surprising for people in Wisconsin that sort of legislation might pass. It was pretty gutsy of Walker to be pushing that in Wisconsin, and the really outpouring of protests that followed was direct response to that surprise. But no, we do see him as very close to ALEC. ALEC, in their recent Rich States, Poor States report, gave Wisconsin a pretty good ranking. They were the only one of these reports, because there are many reports out there that look at the state of an economy in each particular state, and they compare them against each other, and they say how much prospect there is for new jobs in a particular state. And it's become quite well known, both in Wisconsin, where we're based, but also across the entire country, quite how badly Wisconsin has been doing, both in terms of jobs, but also in terms of job creation, both public and private sector, but also in terms of job losses. The state is really suffering, and most people on the right and the left, I mean, the Chamber of Commerce has criticized the policies of Scott Walker. Most people recognize that it is as a direct result of those policies that the state is suffering. But ALEC does not. ALEC really bucked the trend and said, Scott Walker is putting in place the recipe for success in Wisconsin. And that was a big boost for Scott Walker, because although he may be quite a long shot, he has national ambitions, and he's off traveling around the country trying to raise money for a potential presidential bid. And so, ALEC's support is really vital when many others, even in the conservative movement, are abandoning him.
Have you or has any other organization put together kind of an ALEC retrospective? In other words, in 2012 they pushed this issue. Fracking was the big push here. Gun access was the big push here. Can we literally kind of draw a roadmap between the top 10 hits, so to speak, of the extreme right wing?
Yeah, we put out a report that looked at all of the bills that we could identify in the last year that was that we could tie to ALEC. And as I say, it's 466 bills. Now, it's called ALEC at 40, Turning Back the Clock on Prosperity and Progress. And ALEC themselves claim that every year they have around 1,000 bills, 1,000 of their bills introduced, and about 200 become law. When you think about it, when they've been going for 40 years, that's really, 40,000 ALEC bills that have been introduced over the last 40 years, and really a tremendous impact. Many of those bills really fundamentally alter the way that we live our lives. They were instrumental in opposing the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court challenge to the Affordable Care Act in part came from a conflict in the law that began in Florida, where there was a bill that said nobody should be required to take out insurance, essentially. It's actually a relatively short bill. That was an ALEC bill, and ALEC followed that legal challenge right the way from the Florida courts all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they filed a brief in the Supreme Court case. They were instrumental in that case. Obviously, the final decision didn't go the way that they wanted. They would have liked it to be ruled unconstitutional. But they're really tremendously, tremendously influential. I think it's very difficult to underestimate their success, to overestimate their success. We identified bills in this report. We didn't look at every single issue area, but we identified bills that privatize education, that really roll back environmental protections and really promote polluters' agenda. And it will come as no surprise to you to hear that companies that are involved in ALEC's anti-environmental legislation include ExxonMobil, Shell, Koch Industries, BP. I mean, it's really a who's who of every single corporation, with very few exceptions, that are interested in driving a particular profit motivation in each different issue area, be it privatizing our state education and driving that cash away from public schools into private schools through the use of scholarships. They have a scholarship tax credit that corporations are entitled to, whereby if they put up a certain amount of money for children to be able to attend private schools, so this is a scholarship from a corporation for children who would otherwise go to public school to go to private school, which sounds on the face of it a good thing, they are entitled to a tax deduction, which in some states is up to 100% of the amount that they are providing. In other words, this is really public funds being used in order to provide a nice talking point for private corporations so that they can say that they're giving money for education, but really it's actually us, we the public taxpayers, who are using that money in order to subsidize private schools. And so that's kind of typical of the way that ALEC operates, really in a kind of insidious way in order to benefit the corporations.
Now, here we've got an organization that basically is able to hide and multiply corporate money to drive an extreme right-wing agenda. They've got the attention of legislators because they do the heavy lifting of drafting legislation. It's done under the guise of education. Is there, and I think we all know the answer, is there anything comparable to that on the progressive side of the table? Is there a progressive organization that's well-funded that is driving legislation in a progressive direction?
Not really. I mean, there are organizations on the progressive side that create legislation. I mean, there are many organizations, and there are corporations that are drafting legislation that, people on the progressive side might think is good because it doesn't necessarily, focus entirely on the corporation's profit motivations. There are non-profits that draft legislation, but there isn't an organization on the progressive side that has legislators as members in the way that ALEC does. There isn't an organization on the progressive side that drafts this legislation and then lobbies for it in an underhand way. ALEC says that they actually don't do any lobbying, but Common Cause exposed substantial evidence of ALEC lobbying on a really systematic basis for their particular bills. And so there isn't a comparable organization, but really we're not calling for one, because what ALEC is doing, in our view and in the view of Common Cause, who filed a complaint with the IRS, is actually illegal. You know, we don't want to recreate the problems of ALEC. On the other hand, we do want to have debates about the legislation that is being promoted and the legislation that's being passed that affects our the standard of life in terms of healthcare and education and the environment. We want those debates to happen within the state house, and to involve a range of different viewpoints. And where corporations are pushing for these bills, we want it to be clear. We don't want it to be hidden behind the hand of ALEC.
I just wanted to point to the lopsidedness of the issue. Final question I want to ask you, sir. You know, they've paid special attention to destroying, breaking up, making sure that the funding was difficult for the union. What has ALEC's focus been on the union movement?
Well, ALEC has really been laser focused on undermining worker rights and the rights of unions almost since it was created, almost 40 years ago. It's been promoting legislation such as the right to work, but it's also been promoting legislation that makes it much, much more difficult for unions to raise funds, makes it more difficult because requires union members to frequently reapprove union deductions, that there are bills that make it much more difficult for unions to engage in any kind of political activity. And really their entire agenda in terms of the unions is, they would say, not trying to kill the unions. Well, in fact, they wouldn't say this, but it's clear that they're not trying to entirely kill the unions. They're just trying to make them completely irrelevant by removing any ability that the unions have really to organize in any kind of effective way. And, you know, Act 10, the bill that was pushed by Scott Walker in Wisconsin, really is indicative of that, because if the unions don't have any ability to go and collectively bargain on behalf of their employees, then of their members rather, then it makes it very difficult for them to actually ask people to become members. And that's really at the heart of what ALEC is trying to do.
If you want to close with one comment, sir, what would you say about how can we defeat this kind of these tentacles in the American legislative process?
Well, I think people being aware of what ALEC is doing and, you know, asking their legislators and their local newspapers to cover ALEC really has had a tremendous impact. And if we continue to do that, then I think that we will continue to reduce their impact over the next few years.
Thanks again, sir.
Thank you, Rick.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Join the Legion's
auxiliary.
Married life ain't hard. I get a union card. Married man has a happy life if he's got a union wife. So you take care of me, and I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. So you take care of me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
And that was Woody Guthrie. Can't scare us. We stick to the union. I'd like to welcome my first two union guests, Mr. Smith. And Mr. Smith is Chief of Staff, SEIU, and Gypsy Gallardo, organizer with Agenda 2010. Welcome, folks. Welcome.
Welcome.
Hey there. Good evening, Rick.
How are you all doing tonight?
It's a beautiful late summer night in Florida.
Well, you know, that's just great. And I'm so happy I could have you folks join us around the union holiday, the Labor Day weekend, and beyond, because the unions basically built this country. Without the union strength, without the union solidarity, we wouldn't have the country we have today. And I know that you folks are involved in bringing back union strength. Let me start with you, Ms. Gallardo, if I may. Now, why don't you talk to us about Agenda 2010 and beyond, and tell us what you're working on.
Well, Agenda 2010 is a group that actually was founded in 2007. It brought together the heads of approximately 100-plus community-based, majority black, historically black organizations largely, along with other organizations that work in the predominantly African-American community called South St. Petersburg. So Rick and I are on the west coast of Florida. And we happen also, if you can use this as a point of reference, we happen also to be on the end cap of the I-4 corridor in the state of Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And so we brought those folks together, and we agreed to approach collective action projects. So in this case, and those ran the gambit from collective work in the faith community, collective work against to chart major reductions in juvenile crime, collective work in education policy advocacy. And so where we intersect with SEIU in a major way is under a project called Agenda 2010, which launched in 2009 to increase the participation of African Americans in city elections, to create a new means of holding them accountable, to probe them and get them to go on the record about progress that they would make for South St. Petersburg. And then we began happily working with SEIU. Rick, when was it? My goodness.
It was very soon after the founding, I think.
Yeah. And we have been able to, through that liaison, have been able to put some new power, some new focus, and kind of revive the Black community labor connection that has gone dormant, certainly here, but then across America as well.
Well, we've heard some amazing things about St. Petersburg, including that that people's budget that happened. That's absolutely amazing. Mr. Smith, why don't you talk a little bit about the work of SEIU?
Well, we came, the local, Florida Public Service Union local, would be constituted as a state local, and we came in 2009. And imagine coming into a situation where a public sector union where every jurisdiction that you have, and we have like 28 cities, school boards, et cetera, everyone was facing multi-million-dollar deficits. There had been cuts everywhere and deep reductions in the workforce. We also kind of knew the labor movement has to do different and do new kinds of things if we're to even survive at this point. So facing that problem we had ourselves, we just naturally knew is that we can't win this on our own. And any other single issue in the city couldn't win anything on their own anymore. So just kind of out of this principle of solidarity, reacting to the austerity that we were seeing, we moved into this coalition, the People's Budget Review, which is a very broad spectrum. The People's Budget Review is a pretty big tent, and so we moved traditional neighborhood associations with the African-American associations to the gay movement, to the environmental movement, and into the neighborhoods and just talking to regular people on the doors. That was kind of our concept, and that's what we pretty much ended up doing.
Well, you know, if you'll forgive my candor, and believe me, I grew up in a union town up north in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a small suburb called Homestead, where the mills and the railroad were the only way to make any kind of living at all. And so I grew up in a union town. And I'll tell you what, you know, the miracle that you guys have done over there in St. Pete, that story needs to be told. It needs to be told much louder. I mean, so many people live a life where they think that what happens at City Hall is completely out of their control. And to have a people's budget like that, my God, that's amazing. That's fantastic. You guys are to be congratulated.
Wow.
Thanks, Rick. We appreciate it.
Well, think of me as an advocate, folks. Think of me as your advocate.
We are.
Well, let me ask you this. One of the questions I love to ask my guests, because, you know, let's face it, it's hard enough to make a living in this world. It's hard enough to raise a family, put a roof over their heads, keep them going to school, and it takes almost everything most people have just to do that. But you folks have dug in and said, look, that's not enough. You've had to say, I want to do more. I want to help my community. I want to help my town. I want to help my county, my state. Could you talk a little bit about yourselves? Let me ask you first, Gypsy, if I may. What was it in your life that said to you that you had to be involved? You had to do more than just the minimums, just live a corporate or commercial life?
Oh, my goodness. What says that? I grew up in an activist family, but not so activist, right? The elders in my family were mostly politicians, educators, business people. And so I'm not sure how that spark was lit, but I can tell you, Rick, that I'm a real lover of democracy. I'm a real believer in the democratic process and in the working people raising up and charting real change in this country. If you go back, you know the history far better than I do in terms of how, you know, workers really advanced democracy and equality at the turn of the 20th century. And then you roll forward to the civil rights movement, and it was really, you know, folks really focused on the big name people like Martin Luther King Jr., but if you look at the anatomy of that movement at every major milestone, like the Montgomery bus boycott, it was the everyday people. And in fact, I think the president of the NAACP Montgomery at the time was Pullman Porter, if I'm not mistaken, worked on the railroad. So, you know, just the love for seeing people's power exerted and knowing that if we're going to make real policy change and really begin to have society move more to sustainable budgeting and investing in things that create jobs and soak up some of this unemployment, just knowing that we've got to get out there and make that happen.
Well, you know, too many people forget that government comes from We Are the People. And when they talk about bureaucrats, they're talking about us. It just amazes me that bureaucrat has somehow evolved from something we used to know as civil servant. And I salute you. I really absolutely do. Mr. Smith, could you do the same thing, sir? Could you tell us about yourself when you grew up and what made it important to you to give to the community this way?
Well, labor's kind of in the blood, right? I had a great-grandpa that was active wobbly. And
oh, you're kidding. That's awesome.
Two grandfathers who were active in my mom and dad both. So it was just there. We talked about it all the time. And got out of high school and went into the factory, which in 1972 was a logical choice to make. I remember I was making $7.90 an hour in 1972 at a UAW shop. So, you know, fresh from taking my final senior exam to the middle class. And that was appreciated. Worked at the factory for about 9 years, was replaced by a robot, did a year of community organizing, and then started in the labor movement as an organizer in 1981. So, you know, that's just what drives me. But also what Gypsy was saying was we really have power. Regular people have power. And a lot of the strategies, say, on the left is involved with a lot of inside politics or at such a grand scale that your normal everyday guy or woman can't get to. Like you said, their lives are already complex and busy and saddening in many ways. But we knew that's the only thing that could drive this. So even though Gypsy is very brilliant playing political strategies, a lot of our folks we knew we had to go directly door to door, and basically that's how we were able to actually increase taxes in St. Pete so we could keep our services, you know, because we were able to turn out hundreds of regular folks who were saying what they wanted with their money.
You know, it is so refreshing to be able to tell a good story like that. You know, so many times we hear about people being crushed by corporate power, people being ignored by politicians. Not a day goes by you don't hear two dozen stories like that. And when I heard this story that St. Pete people stood up and said, no, we're not going to take that budget you and your cronies think is a hell of a good idea. We're not going to continue the back scratching that goes on. We're actually going to change the agenda and get the agenda working for people, for working class people. And that's, you know, I just can't say enough about it. I think it's fantastic. And I think that that story should be told in every town in this state and in a lot of other states too. But all right, let's go on. So SEIU is doing the work. Maybe there's a lot of people out there that don't know about who SEIU represents or who it supports. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that, Rick?
SEIU stands for the Service Employees International Union. We currently have 2.1 million members, and the composition is kind of what drives the creativity and the sensitivity to these things. Composition of, and we represent healthcare workers, public sector workers, and janitors, building services. The majority of our membership are people of color. The majority of our union are women. About 35% of our members speak another language. This is the American working class at this point in time. So we were perhaps demographically lucky because we listened to what the members say. And I think that, that speaks for SEIU's success in organizing. That the idea and more and clearly and more tightly united with community partners who share the same concerns and kind of we work together to say, look, there is no one issue. One issue, organizing is dead. Everything impacts us. Particularly here in Florida, we know in 30 years, because it's been the papers solidly, we're probably going to be underwater here because of the effects of climate change and sea level rise. So how does getting good jobs help us out in that situation? And you could flip that around, you know. All the issues are interconnected. In fact, life is just interconnected. And that's kind of philosophically where we come from in our organizing.
Oh, that's great. You know, I've been an activist most of my adult life. In fact, it goes back to high school. I was marching for human rights and to end desegregation here in Florida, and marching in opposition to the Vietnam War. And I remember those days when not everybody in the union appreciated the fact that we're all pulling for the same goal. And when I saw the last couple of years, more and more people making that bridge between unions, between environmentalists and peace activists, hunger advocates, voting activists, you know, seeing that come together, it, you know, it makes my heart feel very good. And it makes me believe, despite the fact that they have they own the stores, they own the news, makes me think we got a chance. And, you know, the work that you guys do is a wonderful thing. You're doing it for democracy. You're doing it for human rights. And that's fantastic. So tell me, Gypsy, what do you see ahead this next year or so? What's on your agenda?
Well, I mean, Rick Smith from SEIU has left out what I think is one of the most important facets of this, and he's very modest because I say that because we got together. I heard you in the last segment talk about how the conservatives organized,
right,
and what was happening on the progressive side of the spectrum.
Not enough.
Not enough, but certainly People's Budget Review also made an important inroad in that regard because the way that the initial project happened, we got a survey out to, and I think Rick can tell you better than I, but I think it was over 6,000 citizens in the city during a first time out, went online, filled out the survey, filled out physical surveys door-to-door, physical surveys at churches and so forth. And what you begin to see very clearly is once you ask the questions about, you stripped away the politics, it was politics neutral, it was ideologically neutral, and it was all about what services and amenities do you want in this city, how would you like to see this city spend money, and across the board, conservative and progressive alike wanted to see increased investments in job creation, wanted to see city services preserved and wanted to see the city change and move forward and evolve the way it sets public budgets. And so, you know, you have then, once you can get to that level where you can build a broad enough coalition, now in this second year, Rick Smith, tell me if you agree, I don't see as heavy an emphasis on crossing the aisle, but I think the movement has opened up the public dialogue to the point where these things are not trapped in ideology. You don't have rabid Tea Partiers able to discredit and tear down the ask for certain policy advancements because it hasn't been framed out of the traditional coalition and carried through the traditional means. And just one more comment on that is that we use digital media very heavily. If you know the rise of the conservative echo chamber, the radio talk shows, the blogs, you know, the rise of that whole genre, which quickly began to roar louder than progressive America all over the internet. This was a means of us using that same tool to gain some ground as well. And then you asked me about the future of the movement. I think we've got to keep pushing this year. Again, thanks to Rick Smith, SEIU, we're putting forward some real ask. So last year was about saving some things, saving cuts to city services, saving some jobs, and opening up the dialogue. And this year it's been positioned to make some real ask that advance public sector work in major ways.
Excellent. Thank you, Gypsy. Rick, what do you see as the road ahead, sir?
We'll do fine as Gypsy keeps holding me back from the left. That's a joke, Gypsy. No, it's actually, it's not just strategically important. It is, we began to just ask the questions and find, we feel we're creating a new politics. And that politics is, you pick the basic human issues. Anywhere you can get a majority around those things if you can organize the people around those ideas. So, yes, we demographically displayed the exact, all our supporters were almost 2 percentage points off of any demographic that you could name. So we pick collectively the issues that will resonate with the biggest majorities possible. So this year we went to policy and resources last year after saving things. So our asks this year are money for youth training and job employment. The fact there, and this is universal, it's across the United States, is demographically, public sector is very old. So we calculated in Pinellas County, which is where we're at, that over the next 3 years, 2,500 jobs are going to need to be filled just to stay even. And we're like, well, why not hire our more disadvantaged youth? The unemployment rate for youth is 16.9% in Florida. For African Americans, 30%. It's a huge issue, great consensus across the city. The second thing is 2010 and Gypsy's brilliant idea of creating a CRA and a tax increment funding district to actually decrease poverty in South St. Kitts by 30% by the year 2020. That's the 2020 plan. They need some startup monies. And finally, was the issue of strengthening neighborhoods. Certainly an issue in any city campaign, but this is for real because it gives money directly into the hands of the neighbors to pick projects which have to meet our definition of sustainability, which would be don't harm the environment, help the economy, and let's create more social equity. And next year, I mean, every move you make should be thinking about 2 years down the road. Within these next 2 years, we will be at the place where we will have direct participatory budgeting in the city of St. Pete, you know, for a significant piece of the budget where council districts, however this is figured out, will be able to vote on their own projects. their own funding sources. It's pretty ambitious, but I can see it going that way.
You know, it is to hear about the rebirth of democratic governance is such a miraculous and beautiful thing. You know, I hope you all take a moment to pat yourselves on the back once in a while, because that is so fantastic. When you think, I mean, just recently in Miami-Dade, the good people who govern that area were about to cut funding for libraries and build a stadium for some rich pro ball team. Now, I can't tell you what kind of incredibly insane judgment takes them there. But when I hear that you folks have now taken the reins of budget control into the public hands, it sounds like Athens to me, folks. It really does. Thank you for the work that you're doing. My God, let me ask you this, and either one of you can take this. What would you say to somebody who said, you know, our small town is run by the same people who have been running it for years? How can we get control of the budget like you did? What do you tell people who ask that?
I would say, really? Well, let's go next door and see what the neighbor has to say about that. Oh, bring a piece of paper along, right? And you go three houses down, right? And then those four people are like, yeah, we all feel the same way. Boom, 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 you organize.
I'm a little... I'm more of a tactician. Well, to put it more accurately, I'm more of a maniac about organizing. Not necessarily in a good way, but my advice would be to pull together those exact segments that you mentioned earlier in the show. You mentioned the bringing together of the green sector, the environmental, what used to be called the environmental movement. Uh-huh. You know, bring together some of the education community. An important part, if I look back at what became the important part, it brought together the League of Women Voters. Certainly there are chapters of that all over.
Right.
The NAACP, our group, some of the green folks, it brought together the Council of Neighborhood Associations. So if you just use that as a roadmap and bring those folks together, I guarantee that at any small town where the budgeting process has happened the same way for eons, folks want more of a say. Folks have seen job cuts. They've seen services cut. They've seen the same things that we've seen. Tax revenues have been down for local governments all across America, and more so here in Florida. And so I'd say pull those folks together and tap into that energy, and honestly, it becomes a little bit old school, but new school. In that, you know, we had the young folks there at the table. It certainly wasn't Rick and I. I'm 42. Rick is a gorgeous, you know, sexy 55 or so. but it was the young folks who were in their 20s,
yeah,
and them fresh out of school, who knew how to execute that digital piece of the strategy, knew how to, you know, get the spread of the word on Facebook and link themselves via social media to other progressive networks. And then it gained the traction and let you chart those media milestones. So then you're able to feed to your major local papers numbers, because there was 1,000 people who took part in this within weeks of it launching. And now you're getting attention, because in most small towns across Florida and America, you don't have 1,000 people participating in the budget if you strung 5 years together. So that would be my... And you know what I mean, Rick. So
I know exactly what you mean.
Oh, there used
You're
to be three
generous.
People in there, but I would like to really make a shout out to the youth. None of this would happen without an incredible bunch of under 30s who did help all on the social media. And, you know, I wouldn't know how to tweet if somebody sat me down for 3 hours. But they not only did that, they're actually our ground troops. Young workers, Gypsies Engaged, so many from the Black community, college students. I remember when we started, some kids said, yeah, we're from the SDS chapter. I'm like, is this like a flashback or something? the youth are driving this, and that's the energy. It's what I love to call beginner's mind. Nothing is impossible to them. And whereas myself and Gypsy might say, that's not going to work, we need that kind of thinking.
Well, this has been absolutely amazing. Where is your budgeting process right now for, I guess you're working on 2015 or still 2014, nailing that one?
No, we have two budget hearings, the biggest budget hearing coming up this week on the 12th. We're hoping to organize to fill council, fill the second floor chamber and out the door, because that's how we win. It's very hard to speak against the proposals that the majority wants.
Sure.
It's 500 people staring you down.
You know, you have some very large educational institutions in the St. Pete area. Have they been involved in this process, of their, whether it be their political departments or sociology departments?
All of them. I mean, we've engaged, I guess, experts and consultants from there, both on kind of the data collection and stuff that we're doing, but also we've had anthropologists come over and like, what are you guys doing? we picked up our best organizer. It was like anthropologists asking questions. With the University of South Florida and St. Petersburg, and, you know, different people come around, but we also, when everybody sits at the table every Monday night, like I said, we're a pretty big tent, so everyone from that SBS guy to the Chamber of Commerce is sitting there. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, that's real democracy in action, and I just can't I can't thank you enough, and I wish you every success, good people. You are examples of the best kind of organizing, the best kind of citizen democracy, and I just thank you so much for the work that you're doing. You're giving a lot of people
hope. Thanks for having us.
Okay. Well, and any final remarks you'd like to make, Gypsy?
Well, yeah, I would love to give a shout-out. If any of your listeners are in the Tampa Bay area or on the west coast of Florida, we've got two events coming up. Rick mentioned September 12th, and we really want to just basically descend on City Hall and have just the strongest showing that they may have ever seen on September 12th and September 26th, when we really put those demands forward and hope to show them enough of a coalition and enough people there to really impress upon them that this city wants to see this really take flight. So if we could just give a shout out and then direct people to peoplesbudgetreview.org for more info, that would be it for me. And thank you for having us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Just we make a good team. She takes care of that stuff.
Absolutely. peoplesbudgetreform.org.
People's Budget Review.
Review.
Yeah, .org.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, folks. I really appreciate you coming on, and I hope you'll come back on after you get your next budget set, okay?
Okay,
sure
thank
will.
You.
And if there's ever anything we can do for you, just let me know, okay? You got my number.
Okay, thanks, gotcha. Rick.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye. Let me bring on my next guest, and this is, let's see here. Is this Mr. Ridley?
No, this is Mr. Mayfield, actually.
Oh, Mr. Mayfield, welcome, sir, welcome. I'd like to introduce Alfonso Mayfield, president of SEIU, Florida Public Services Union. Welcome, sir. Thank you for coming back.
Well, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Sir, why don't you talk a little bit about what's going on with SEIU?
Well, I think you just talked to some of our brothers and sisters, Rick Smith and Jesse Galato.
Yes.
As I mentioned once before, the last time I was on the show, our approach to building the union has taken a much wider component. We've been trying to, our members have expressed a desire to not only, advocate for things on their work sites, but also in their communities. So we've been actually on the forefront of a school reform here in Palm Beach County in a couple of areas to try and create a more inclusive, holistic environment for kids and for workers and for the community and dealing with educational issues from the standpoint of income inequality, not just from what happens in the classroom, because kids don't just stop learning in the class when they leave the classroom. And then there's also what we've been trying to do around economic development and around building a base for job creation throughout Palm Beach County and the rest of the state.
Great. Could you hold on 1 second, sir? One of my guests from earlier had just called back in. Go ahead.
Sure.
Is this Gypsy or Rick?
This is Rick. I was just calling back to listen to the show.
Oh, okay, fine. No problem. Well, then hang in there.
So I'll be here, but I'm listening to the show. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. So, Mr. Mayfield, so SEIU, Service Workers, tell me again, the acronym SEIU stands for?
Service Employees International Union.
Great, great. So SEIU has been branching out and working not just should we say on the job front, but also working with the larger community. Why don't you go talk about that agenda, sir?
Sure. Well, I think it's not even anything that's really specific. I think it's more of a frame of mind. It's not even branching out. If you look at where our members live, our members are very diverse. There are teachers, their parents, their Sunday school teachers, their football coaches. They are pastors and deacons in the community. They wanted to take on an agenda that was going to be about bettering the community and making it more sustainable for the long term. So this was the natural matriculation over time to them saying, look, we're organized. We want to take what we're doing and talk to our neighbors about how we can make the community better. And so this has been happening over the course of the past few years. This has resulted in several people being elected, including the school board, and some pretty progressive and interesting policies, like the People's Budget Review, which was mentioned earlier, also like some CRN development work that's been mentioned in Delray Beach. I think the thing that we're most proud of is that we have not, as a union, tried to take ownership of the work that we've done. What we have tried to focus on is building an environment that was going to be inclusive. We're not doing this from the standpoint of saying that we have all the ideas, because we don't think that that's the case. The only thing that we want to do is to help build a convening table that allows all different segments of the community, from the right and the left, to say, how can we have a conversation about what's going to make our community better and what does that look like? In some places, it may look like People's Budget Review. In some places, it may look like something like Roosevelt Leadership Academy in Palm Beach County, which is a school that is, the community is coming around to try to raise money for, and also to kind of figure out how they can help make the curriculum and environment for the school more inclusive, or something like Village Academy in Delray Beach, Florida, which came from the community. So
I think Mr.
On.
Excellent. Let me bring in. I think Mr. Ridley just arrived. Mr. Ridley,
hello.
Welcome.
Thank
sir.
You for welcoming. How are you?
Oh, very good. The Mr. Mayfield was just talking about the work of SEIU, and why don't you go ahead and just take a moment, Mr. Ridley, and tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing as well.
Well, thank you first for having me on. I happen to be a community activist living in the Delray Beach area, and I've been doing the work in Delray Beach for over 20 years. In a neighborhood that's best defined as a neighborhood that have many persons who are vulnerable, live below the poverty line, often disenfranchised, at least with working with systems. But it also have a nice mixture of professional and working class families. And so it's a nice neighborhood with challenges, but certainly capacity to make a difference.
Great. Mr. Mayfield, I would think that the service workers are having probably more pressure on them because they work in a lot of civic situations. I imagine there's a lot of pressure on those jobs, whether it be to limit the rehires or cut budgets. Are you seeing impact on existing contracts?
Well, most definitely. I think there's a catch-22 when you talk about public employees, and I remember specifically where you're talking about people who live in communities, and you're talking about a situation where over the past few years budgets have been cut pretty deeply. And if there was any fat to begin with, there isn't any now, so you're cutting into bone. So you have people who are doing significant amounts of work on top of significant amount of work and have done really good jobs of doing more with less, while at the same time dealing with the pressure of having their jobs outsourced in some instances or having positions that have not been filled, right?
So, right.
Where I think the biggest thing that I hear how they're impacted is the fact that they want to do a good job and they feel that the services that they deliver are important. So the cry from the community to say we want more services and the cry from the workers saying we want to be able to deliver a quality service is the same. It's pretty analogous when you listen to it.
When the governor of Florida and the, we'll call it the legislature for lack of any other better word in polite company, when they advance the cause of charter schools, when they start privatizing prisons, obviously this hurts workers. And there was a victory of sorts, wasn't there? Wasn't some of that privatization cut back or limited?
The privatization as it relates to the prison, that was limited last year, but it's going to keep coming up. It's going to be an ongoing fight.
Let me ask you, this, it may sound like a simple question, but I think it speaks volumes about the agenda of some of these people. Why, since they don't make the case that this is cost effective, why do they think that this is a good thing for our society, that we privatize the schools, that we privatize the prisons? What do you think is driving their agenda? Is it just simply greed?
Well, I think it's a myriad of things. And I think that the one thing that we have to do as progressives, to be quite frank with you, is I think we have to have an honest argument around why this is happening. Over the course of the history of anything, there are always going to be advancements. There are always going to be, ways to streamline things and make them better from a certain standpoint. The charter schools aren't a monolith. Privatization isn't necessarily a monolith. There are some things that they transition, and they may transition into a new role for workers, and that's good. All charters are not the same. The problem that, to me fundamentally comes up is when you have for-profit entities who come into a community and those jobs are privatized and given to those companies, and those companies do not employ people in the community, they do not pay a living wage, they do not educate our kids, but they take the money, and then they take that money out of that local economy and send it someone else, that exacerbates the greater problem. And it all comes from a place of a free market belief or some neoliberal belief that, okay, well, if we just open it up to private industry, then somehow that's going to make everybody richer and that's going to be a better quality product. And it's been proven time and time again that that is not the case. The economies of scale do not match up always when that happens. Sometimes it does, but a lot of times it doesn't. So there has to be a real conversation that our members should be in the middle of and the community should be in the middle of to say, we want the highest quality services to be delivered. Working people depend on public services. When they are delivered crappily because of bureaucratic nonsense, it hurts the community, right? It hurts the workers. We want to cut that out of the way so that the services that are being delivered are great. And take the profit motive out of it. If your only motive is to say how you can make someone else money, that's not necessarily going to serve the public. And I don't know if that answers the question to get my rant.
Yeah, sure. No, it did. It did. I've heard several of these discussions with people who wanted to privatize. I can think of one in particular in prisons, and I heard them say, well, where's your evidence that this is going to be cost effective? They said, no, that's not the idea. We just want to get out of this business. We want to privatize it just on general principles, as if privatizing it, making it a for-profit situation, is somehow going to make it magically better, and there's no evidence to that effect. And I can't help but think of Go ahead.
Well, you know, I would actually like to ask Chuck's opinion about this, too, because, I mean, thinking about it from this perspective, like what happened in the legislature, so you're going to privatize the prisons and then say that you guarantee a minimum number of prisoners in the prison? So how are you going to guarantee that, right? So you're setting up a system where you're saying you're going to incarcerate people and on, you know, on anything primarily, and I know, you know, Chuck has a pretty long history of dealing with at-risk youth and crime prevention programs. So, I mean, Chuck, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I'll certainly I concur that people in neighborhoods, in the neighborhood I live in and neighborhoods like the neighborhood I live in, certainly look for quality services, and we do absorb much of our services from the public sector. You know, there's just certain things that don't make sense to us, and the one that makes the least amount of sense to us is that we're supposed to buy that by privatizing certain systems, particularly when you talk about the prison system, that's supposed to make it more effective and efficient. And I'm glad that you asked the question in regards to where is the evidence that it's more effective. But it's also some things like just take common sense. If you take the profit motive out, would a private sector be engaged other than looking for how it would get to its profit? So I am not here to make the argument that the public sector has done things well, effective, and efficient. But that can be, you know, you can fix that. The answer, I mean, I just can't buy. There is, I mean, just based on the evidence, I can look around and use my common sense and see that the private sector, the business model, got lots of flaws and problems. And so the question is, how do we get the voices to the table and then create a power base with those voices who have been most marginalized so that we can have a conversation that leads to positive results at the end? I believe that part of the flaw in the conversation has been the lack of power of those communities who need these services the most but haven't had the capacity to make their voice be heard and force results when others disagree.
Absolutely. And, you know, you bring up another important point. Too much of this, these for-profit prisons are literally designed with a motive built in to incarcerate more and more people. We already have too many people incarcerated for a variety of victimless crimes. And that's a whole other conversation that needs to happen, because it's absurd the number of people we have incarcerated in this country. And the way to fix that is not by making cheaper prisons that are for profit and gouging the prisoners and their families. That's not the way to fix the problem, that's for sure. Go ahead.
Well, I would say, you know, you have to also look at the cycle of it. So, you know, we're operating within a political dynamic now where you're saying that, you know, I saw a legislator or a congressman the other day said that, you know, a kid not being able to get food at school, that's a learning moment for that kid that they should work hard and not be poor. That's absurd. You know what I'm saying? So
sure.
You have a criminalization. You have a criminalization of the poor. You have, an attempt by the right to say, we're going to take away every opportunity for someone to make any type of vertical move out of their circumstances. Oh, and by the way, if you mess up in any way, we're going to put you in jail, and we're going to make money off of it. And when we put you in jail, we're going to put you to work and not pay you an hourly wage. We're going to pay you really nothing, but we're going to make money off of it. It's absurd. The role of the government around some of the critical services specifically, I'm not talking about like lawn care and all that. Prison education was designed for the greatest public good for the largest audience of the community, right? You're saying now, to say you want to get out of that business, they're saying you want to get out of the business of doing the public good. You can't do that. You can't abdicate that responsibility and think that that's going to be okay. Because essentially what you're doing is you're ceding the direction of our country to corporate interests who have a vested interest in keeping their coffers fool and it being kept fool by a certain way. And that just doesn't work.
You're absolutely right, sir. Let me ask you this, Mr. Mayfield. When we see, thank God, unions and broader spectrums of across the community, whether it be voting rights groups or ecological groups or the justice groups pulling together, that didn't used to happen. What do you think has changed within? I'm going to put the responsibility on unions because I know in the past unions didn't reach out this way, but now they are. Is it because of the straits that unions have come in that they've reached out and accepted a broader role in the community?
Well, yeah, I think that's part of it. And to be quite frank with you, I think it's one of those adages: you adapt or you die. But I would also like to believe from knowing some of the people that have been involved in those conversations, that you have people who that there's a window in time that appears where you realize that the one interest advocacy organization no longer exists. So, everything is tied to everything else. Like we just talked about, a few minutes ago, with prisons and with crime and with income inequality, which directly relates to education level when you talk about school to prison pipeline. So there has to be a broader purview, and I think unions are structured in a way where they can address this. Now, us as a labor movement are going to have to make some very strong fundamental changes in how we approach the work. But I think it's to see that all these things are interconnected. If you want to build a better life for your members, which we do, you want to make sure that they can make more money, which you do, you want to make sure that they can take care of their family, you do, then you need to also expand the educational opportunities for their children. You want to make sure that their job actually, that they exist for one thing, and that they're also quality and that they're paid well. But you also want to create an environment that, other entities can operate, and businesses can also make a profit, but that those profits also come back down to the workers, but that those profits also invested in the community. So it's more than just one thing. They're all interconnected, and you have to treat it as such.
I look back and I see those days when the groups did not align so well, and I take such heart when I see environmentalists and justice movement and unions all coming together today. It really gives me hope for the future. And the amazing work that they had accomplished in St. Pete and Pinellas County, that's just so remarkable. I hope that story gets told wider and wider because it's such a success story. Let me ask you this. I've kind of put the onus on unions, but tell me, what do you think has changed about corporate mentality from Henry Ford's idea that if I don't pay my workers well, how can they afford our products, to this kind of mentality that seems to be out there now that you're going to have 1% that's going to own everything and the rest of us will all be indentured servants to them? How do you think we can speak effectively to corporate power and help them understand that we're all in this together? What do you think some of the angles we might approach this at?
Well, I don't know if things have fundamentally changed. I just think that, to be quite frank, I think the hustle has changed. You look at the Gilded Age historically. You look at the Gilded Age, and it was the same thing. What's going on now, very eerily mirrors what happened all the way up until the Great Depression. You had the centralization of wealth within a very small group of people, and you had that moving the body politic of the country in a direction that was benefiting large corporations and the consolidation of power and interest. It's the exact same thing. I think that what changed is that after you had that, usually big social disasters, either wars or depressions, have the ability to create a reset button. And that allowed a reset button that through, the president of the time, FDR, and because of the labor movement and because of the civil rights movement, that there was a big push for equality and to give people an actual chance to be able to move up and improve their circumstances. I think that what happened was a very silent reset moment that we were not prepared for and that we did not deal with well, and that was globalization. So now someone can live in West Palm Beach, Florida, and they can make all of their money and have all their employees here, but they cannot turn around and make the decision that they're going to ship their production off site and maybe in another foreign country where they want to pay taxes, and they're going to deposit their profits in another country so that they don't have to pay taxes on them. And they realize because of the contributions that they put that the government is not going to say, well, no, you can't do that. That's what has changed. And so the leverage that the labor movement has, you at every point in time have to be able to make sure that they know that you have the ability to hurt them and that you're going to force the argument for equality. When that cannot happen and when they feel like that they don't have to, that there is no threat there, they can ignore you. And we have to change that. And I think that the work that we're doing with the community partially says that. You can't ignore your workers. You can't ignore your customers. You can't ignore the people that live next door to you if we're loud enough and if we're vocal enough and if we're demanding having an interface for input.
Wow. You're absolutely right, sir. Thank you so much. Let me ask you both this question. I like to ask it of all my guests because it, to me, is part of the miracle that is a good progressive activist. Mr. Mayfield, let me ask you first, sir. What was it in your early life that made you, that guided you to be a person that works for his community the way you do? It's enough for most people to just make a living, keep a roof over their heads, have a family, but that special thing that drives an activist to do work for their community. What was it in your life, sir?
It was my mom. My mom was a home care worker. My mom took care of people for over 20 years. And I saw my mom working 12, 15 hours a day, you know, for most of her life, had physical issues or is having physical issues later in life because of that. But she did it all so that I would have the opportunity to go to college. And she did it all so that I would have, you know, above and beyond what she had so that I could have a better chance and provide for my family and my kids. But my mom also told me one thing. She said that you have a responsibility to the people whose back you're standing on to get where you are. So whenever I see another kid in the community, regardless of color, it's my responsibility to help make sure that the future is a little bit better for them. It's my job to make sure that when I see somebody like Chuck or somebody like Gypsy, and they're fighting the good fight, and their fight is about making sure that the community has a say in what's going on, in what's happening in the political spectrum, it's my job to help them if I have the ability, and to do that without ego. It's about serving those constituents. And that was beat into me from the time I was a small child, and I remembered that. The only way we will get through this, because this is a dark period, it may not feel like it, but it is, that we're going to have to stand together and we're going to have to support each other and we're going to have to serve humanity to be able to take us to a better place.
Absolutely, sir. So did you work in politics when you were in college? Did you get involved after school?
I started working my first political job when I was 14.
No kidding.
I remember when I was 12, my aunt, who has been a very serious Democrat for all her life, having conversations with me about the problems of Reagan's tax policy when I was a little kid. And she had those conversations with me, and she was another driving force about, you know, supply-side economics doesn't work. You know, and I was like, what is supply-side economics? So.
You know, I mean... Well, I think of my own children, how many political arguments they've heard and how they roll their eyes. I'm sure you rolled your eyes once or twice, too, but I see you did the heavy lifting, sir. Thank you so much. Mr. Ridley, can I ask you the same question, sir?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so what was it in your early life that made you be a person that has to give back?
Well, a couple of things. I had the fortune of being a product of the segregated era and have parents who were both pastors and community activists. So I grew up watching folk who were heavily engaged in the struggle. But what actually moved me into becoming active was, unfortunately, I succumbed to a severe crack cocaine problem in the 80s. And as a part of recovering, I came back to the same neighborhood that was infested with the obscene drug and lifestyle that I helped create. And so in order to protect my own children, I had to become engaged in taking back our neighborhood because the same guys who sold me drugs were standing in front of my house selling drugs. I had kids in the house who were now becoming old enough to either start engaging in the crack cocaine sales or start using the drugs themselves. And I just couldn't stomach having that happen. And so I got a couple of friends to volunteer, and we created a local chapter of a group called Mad Dads in Delray Beach. And 20 years, a generation later, I'm still engaged.
Oh, wow. That's incredible, sir. Thank you so much for the work that you do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know, we deliver a fair amount of bad news for people who haven't heard about this and haven't heard about that. Because of the news covering the silliness that it covers so much, but when I can hear a story shared like that, it just does me good, and I think it does a lot of people good to hear about the good work that drives so many hardworking progressive activists. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me. Let me ask you, Mr. Mayfield, if there was something that you thought people needed to know about SEIU, what would you say? What do people need to know about SEIU?
One thing. We're here, and we're standing with you to make a better America.
That's awesome. Are there any SEIU events coming up, sir?
I'm sure that there are, but I honestly don't have the list in front of me. Chuck
sure,
may
no
know
problem.
Some things, I think. A female communications person will be able to get that information to you.
Okay.
Alfonso, I think you would be correct. You have a convention coming up at the end of the month. Is the date September 28th?
Thank you, Chuck. Yeah, I forgot my own convention. Yeah, we have a convention coming up.
Sorry about that.
That's
Mr. Ridley, are there... Do you have any community activities coming up in Delray Beach that people should know about?
Yes. But Alfonso, did you finish with the convention? Did I get the date
sure,
right?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. You were right, sir. Thank you. Okay. Absolutely. We'll be meeting this Tuesday night to have our first discussion between the broader community, folk who live in the working class community of Delray, and what we call in our neighborhood, the blue-collar workers, who are the public service workers who are part of the local that Alfonso represents. And, the conversation between us is to look at how do we get to the win of all the things that Alfonso has brought to us was how to win. We didn't know how to do that. We knew how to work hard. We knew how to advocate. We knew how to shout. We knew how to be persistent. But we didn't know how to win, so we always ended up frustrated. And the local has shown us how to win over the last couple of months.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both so much. I sure appreciate you coming on, giving us the good news about what's going on with our union friends. Thanks so much, and come back anytime, okay?
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's been our pleasure, believe me, our pleasure. Thanks, gentlemen. Take care. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Okay, let me bring on a little bit more music, and then we'll go into our next story.
Get you a man that's a union man. Join the ladies' auxiliary. Married life ain't hard. I get a union card. And a married man has a happy life if he's got a union wife. So you can't spare me. I'm sticking to the union.
You know, one of the songs that captured a lot of the spirit of organizing over the years is this one. I want to share with you. It's called "I Don't Want Your Millions, Mister."
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. What I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again. Now I don't want your Rolls Royce, mister. I don't want your pleasure yacht. All I want, just food for my baby, is to me my old job back. We work to build this country, mister, while you enjoyed a life of ease. You've stolen all that we built, mister. Now our children starve and freeze. So I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. Call me green or blue or red, this one thing I sure know, mister, my hungry babies must be fed. Take the two old parties, mister, no difference in them I can see. But with a farmer labor party, we could set the people free. So
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
Okay, next thing I want to do is I want to thank my good friends in Progressive Broadcasting. I want to thank Gwen Holden-Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. Another show you shouldn't miss. It's on just before us here on Blog Talk. Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy. It's on tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. I'll be one of the guests tomorrow night. Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women Media. Susan Nylon, the Nylon Report's on every weekday at 5 o'clock. The Sarasota area, both online and in the air. Sita Baguil, her show is Sita Media, out of the Melbourne area. Harriet Lehrman, her show Voice of the People, out of the Boca area, if I'm not mistaken. And Rob Abston's Smile, It's Only Politics. All good progressive advocates and broadcasters you should tune into and support their shows as well. A couple things I want to share with you. Of course, you know that there are those who would take us to war once again, hoping that bombs will lead us to peace. Sort of odd thinking, if you ask me. I have contacted several civil servants who represent us here in Florida. This is the response I got back from Patrick Murphy, normally a reasonably fair-minded Democrat. Patrick Murphy's response, I only going to include part of it. I strongly condemn the use of chemical weapons against innocent civilians by the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Assad must be held accountable for his flagrant violations of international law and standards, and others must know that such crimes against humanity will not be tolerated by the United States or the international community. I guess he's seen something convincing that most of us have not. I support President Obama's decision to come to Congress before taking action. It is in the interest of U.S. national security as well as moral imperative. The use of chemical weapons should be stopped. If this is an international law, if you ask me, it should be taken to the international court. He concludes, but and ultimately any decision to take military action should be made collectively as a nation. I stand ready to engage in this debate. I'm awaiting the final language resolution to see the limits of authorization before he can make any decision. But he says, I am pleased to see that putting boots on the ground is not an option under discussion. And not to say that it's really ruled out, but it's not under discussion, evidently. And on that heading that we're all being monitored, you know, our friends overseas are not so thrilled. Reading your email, Associated Press, NSA spied on Brazilian and Mexican presidents. Hey, you're not the only ones being monitored. Glenn Greenwald, whose partner, by the way, when he had his electronic equipment taken from him, they said it was for terrorism's sake, but yet they never asked him anything about terrorism. Isn't that funny? Who's surprised there? However, Glenn Greenwald, relying on a number of recent documents from the NSA surveillance whistleblower, Edward Snowden, has revealed that the NSA spied on communications of both the Mexican and Brazilian presidents. According to the article, Greenwald told the Brazilian news program Fantástico that a document dated 2012 shows that Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto's emails were being read. That document date is a month before Peña was even elected. So they were spying on him before he was president. So, how about that? And then under the thinking outside the box for peace's sake, Representative of Massachusetts, Jim McGovern, a liberal Democrat, is urging the president to withdraw his request for congressional authorization for a military strike on Syria. I don't think the support is there, he said on CNN's State of the Union, adding there are other things that Congress has to deal with. McGovern, who opposes a strike, God bless him, give peace a chance, the Democrats aren't afraid of crossing the White House. Look, I'm a big supporter of Barack Obama, McGovern said, but sometimes even friends can disagree. It's not a question of party loyalty. It's a question of what's right to do. The White House, McGovern said, has shown an inability to think outside the box. And there are other options besides striking or not striking Syria. And with that, I'm going to say... And that's about it for tonight. So we're going to leave you with There's a Better World a Coming. And we'll see you next week. We've got a Women's Power Show. Women's Rights and Human. See you next week.
There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see? There's a better world that's a-coming, and don't you know, no. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you know? I'm a union man in a union war, it's a union world I'm fighting for. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you know? There's a better world that's a-coming. There's a better world to coming. There's a better world to coming. I'll tell you why. Don't you see? And don't you know? Hey. There's a better world to coming. I'll tell you why.
I'm your host, Rick Spiezak, news director of Progressive News Network, saying
there's a better world to coming.
Better
tell
world
you why. Better world to coming. I'll tell you why. Out of marching, out of battling, you can hear the chains are rattling. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. Now there's a better world that's a-coming, and there's a better world that's a-coming, and there's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, and don't you see. Better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you see. There's a there's a better world that's a-coming. I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming. I'll tell you why. We'll beat them on the land, in the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming. I'll tell you why. Well, there's a better world that's a-coming. Don't you see? Better world that's a-coming. Don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world a-coming, don't you see? There's a better world a-coming, don't you see? Better world a-coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world that's a-coming, don't